Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Sorry to some of you, we had to move the venue because of a larger audience, but if you're here, you're here, and if you're not here, you're not here, so I can't apologise to you, but thanks for coming along. Now, Rodney Cavalier is at the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of Power Crisis, the Self-Destruction of a State Labor Party, and he's going to speak for us tonight on the road travelled in writing the Power Crisis. But I'll introduce him very briefly. Most of you here know him. Rodney Cavalier is a political historian. He was Minister for Education in the Rann and Unsworth Labor governments in New South Wales, and he writes frequently for the press and in academic publications on politics, on the Labor Party, and on sport. And he remains an active, and it says on the book, and despairing, but you might say an active but despairing member of the Labor Party, and he's here tonight to talk on why he wrote the book and how he wrote the book. Rodney Cavalier, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared, and thank you to everyone who has come tonight. I was very confident that I would be the published author of books, plural, before I was 30. Having never been a Marxist, I read George Orwell, mainstream political biography, texts on labour history. My journal of preference was New Statesman. In the late 1960s, going into the 70s, I was greatly taken with the new journalism as it emerged in the Esquire of that time, a magazine of great writing and long essays, unlike the magazine of that name of this day. One read the New Yorker, wherever you could come upon it, which was not many places. I loved the writings of Norman Mailer, Tom Wolfe, Truman Capote. I was much impressed that what began as articles became the basis of books. I especially liked writing based on eyewitness reportage. I appreciated the skills of a reporter in being there, partially involved or very involved, yet retaining the observer's eye. Witnesses to the event, conscious of an audience beyond the moment, may get to scratch the occasional note, often without looking down. Provided that the movement of pen over paper does not alert others to their status, as the presence of a reporter can be an issue, it can also alter the objective reality of behaviour. Whatever the notes taken, if any, the writers I admired build their accounts from memory shortly afterwards. It was not a stream of consciousness. As much as they could, they checked facts. They checked exhaustively. Colour was not inserted at the expense of accuracy. The unverified perished. Reading this writing was very influential on a bloke who was 20 and thereabouts. The books most influential were works of journalism, exemplifying the journalist's techniques. And I could cite among many, but particularly George Orwell, Homage to Catalonia, Norman Mailer, Miami and the Siege of Chicago, Truman Capote, In Cold Blood. And I enjoyed just as much the tales of how these authors wrote their pieces, where they did it, how they did it, the space they did it in, the time it took, whether it was longhand, typewriters, whatever. And at the same time as I was reading all of this, proof that you never read more than when you are hopelessly busy, I was finding that immersion in politics does not lend itself to public observations on what you're doing. At all meetings I kept detailed notes, extraordinarily detailed really, sometimes annotated afterwards. Party meetings, faction meetings, public meetings, meetings that I would swear under oath did not take place. Very occasionally I wrote these accounts up, usually be read aloud to an audience of one or two or three, such as the late Jeff Shaw, when we gathered to discuss politics, which was pretty well whenever we were not practising politics. I just pause there to acknowledge my gratitude that Peter Coleman has come tonight, because a good deal of those years between 1970 and later. We devoted late at night to trying to win the seat of Fuller. And it's no small point of pride that Fuller had only two members in the New South Wales Legislative Assembly, and as of this month, both of them are published authors. And I'm greatly honoured that you're here, Peter. I kept a diary. It was disconnected. More gap years than diary. My diary, as an expression of unbroken discipline, began in June 1986, on that fateful day when Neville Wran advised the New South Wales ALP annual conference that he was standing down as Premier. On the stage that day, I can remember my emotions ultra clear. Sitting behind Neville, I felt like the best part of my life was passing. I had not recorded in any sort of systematic way what I'd seen. I had to act now. From that day forward, I kept a daily diary. I resolved I would, and amazingly I did, written day by day, missed occasionally, but not often. Not fewer than 500 words per day, often twice that output, sometimes dramatically more than that output, 24 years of it now, times 365 days. You can work out for yourself the volume of it all and the dementia that drove it. Among it, one hopes, is material of value. Certainly I've been able to mine those pages for any number of my own purposes, settle disputes, save one author from a certain defamation writ. You can read a published chapter on the Rand Cabinet in Troy Bramston's The Rand Era, which is almost entirely drawn from my daily diaries. I found that they were a far better source than any newspaper. I didn't use a newspaper at all. The diary told the story of what I wanted to write about. That was because it was and is a chronicle. There was no agenda, no angles, no concern for public reception. The subject matter was confidential. Very little that ever happens in Cabinet reaches the media, and only what reaches the media is the decision reached, not how Cabinet reached that decision or failed to reach a decision. The audience of the writing about what we were doing was me alone, except for a very few occasions when Bob Carr and I offered readings to each other. The Cabinet entered this tale not as some central driving imperative, but as one part of one person's daily life. Without being conscious of technique, I had chanced upon what a great writer had discovered for herself. On 20 January 1919, Virginia Woolf wrote in her diary, words most apposite, and I quote, "If I stopped and took thought, it would never be written at all. And the advantage of the method is that it sweeps up accidentally several stray matters which I should exclude if I hesitated, but which are the diamonds of the dust heap." That's exactly right. Before the diaries were my notebooks, my first large-scale writings were the executive and campaign reports for the Fuller State Electric Council and for the Glasel State Electric Council. John Faulkner borrowed these files, this sort of thickness, for his speech at the Sydney Cricket Ground last week. I haven't been able to bring myself to look at all of that stuff. He noted that the shortest monthly report was 20 pages, one attained 47. This was on foolscap paper, small font, a word, of course, we didn't know at the time. All of this for an audience of about 11 delegates, plus John Faulkner and Ernie Chapels of Sydney University. But where this book begins, its genesis, is that blessed passage of years when Sally Ray, my partner, presented the world with our children, Alison Elizabeth and Nicholas Ferguson Spofforth. We had moved to Barrel, joined the Southern Highlands branch of the ALP. We had a three-month-old. Sally, within a short while, became secretary. With her PNC background, she started a chatty newsletter in place of the board meeting notice. If you're in a political party, you'd probably know that you tend to get a notice saying, the next meeting of the Huntersville branch will take place on Tuesday the 14th of February at the Huntersville Tennis Club, about to make an error here, Woolwich Road, Huntersville. The meeting will start at 8 p.m. That's it. And the same notice, with just a few things changed, applies from what I've seen to every branch of every party. So to get something which actually said, the trees were green in Loseby Park last Wednesday, I hope you saw them, people were just blown away. People rang up to Sally to say thanks, which impressed me greatly. So I added some items of my own to Sally's notice. We went over one page into a second, and people were very grateful for this effort. Then Sally went and got herself pregnant for the second time and felt the need to stand down as branch secretary. I became secretary of the branch after swearing 20 years earlier I'd never do this again for the usual reasons. No one else wanted to do it. No one else was willing to do it. Absolutely no one else would do it. So a one-page newsletter was my inheritance. which became two pages, and two pages remained for a good while, then four. I started to chance my arm beyond branch doings, then beyond politics. I broke four pages. Eight was not sufficient, nor 12. The breakthrough occurred in 1999, a very long essay on Bradman, Bowerell, and the First World War. Having been mightily offended by a book on Don Bradman, by an English peer, an English Labour peer, I get to say, Charles Williams, who asserted that the matter of the First World War largely passed Bowerell by. You only have to see the war memorials to know what a captious defamation that was. So I was determined to prove it wrong. My source was the holdings of the Southern Mail, a newspaper of the time, held by the Berrima District Historical Society for all of the years of the Great War. And so I invested days, which turned out to be weeks, which just kept on going, scrolling microfiche as the tragedy of Gallipoli, the Western Front, the campaign for conscription unfolded in front of my eyes. For a community where the business of the First World War had largely passed Bowerell by, it was not what I was seeing in the newspapers. It was powerful stuff because I knew the fate of these young men who were being farewelled, some of them slipping away, these huge parties of farewell. And I, of course, noted with pleasure and interest the names of Menzies and Watman, which are the line that produce Don through their connection with George, and other names that are still around today. And the research and the writing of those long days, typed up at night, provide the skein of this book. You cannot understand Australian Labor unless you understand what happened to the party in 1916 over conscription. The ALP has recovered from Lang. It has recovered from the great split of the 1950s. It has not recovered from conscription. Essays are not a book. Good people pleaded with me as these essays kept coming. There's a book here. And I replied, apart from you and me and John Faulkner, who's interested? Maybe they were right, but I hope they're wrong. And that book is hopefully proof that they were right and I was wrong. This book began as a serial, very 19th century. An essay which might have stopped after the first and only instalment went on because the story itself went on. In February 2008, the media was overdosing on the salacious possibilities of a story about a blonde, sex and bribes at Wollongong City Council. At the same time, inside the papers, just a small story was the assertion that the New South Wales government, the Yemma government, was going to proceed with the sale of the state's electricity industry and was not, this time, going to brook a decision to the contrary by the New South Wales Annual Conference, the ALP's sovereign body. If the Yemma government was truly bent on defying conference, then this was a story for the ages. So I wrote an essay, Forget Wollongong, Electricity is the Potential Government Killer. Conference being sovereign, it can direct the Labor government to do or not do whatever conference decides. This is a principle of Labor's governance that goes back to the party's beginnings in 1891. The question was settled beyond doubt in 1892 at the first state conference. The casualties in the ranks of state parliamentary Labor were immediate. Of the 35 MPs elected at the first outing, easily the greatest debut of any political party in Australian history, more than a dozen were expelled, including a future Prime Minister in Joseph Cook. So this was a matter settled in blood. It was intrinsic to Labor's governance. The conference in 1894 introduced a pledge which bound every Labor candidate to vote as Labor in conference decided. Every candidate standing for the ALP, in all the years since, each and every time that they have sought this pre-selection, must sign that pledge. It's an obligation as solemn and as binding for me as any oath made to God. Over the years, the obligations of the pledge have been enforced regardless of cost, most terribly in 1916 over conscription. So I thought it was very likely this was a beat-up. But a second essay, The Story Very Much Alive, explored the fundamental question of Labor governance. Who decides? For the express discomfort of the Catholics in our ranks, I drew an extended parallel with the needs of Henry VIII for a male heir and the assistance of the Church in Rome that the divorce was not lawfully possible. And Gerard would know who I had in mind, that I thought anyone who had a portrait of Thomas More in their barrister's chambers would surely understand what I was saying. I had a lot of fun noting that no good Catholic could possibly identify with other than the party against the designs of a willful ruler. The McKill model of New South Wales Labor government was created by William McKill, the New South Wales Premier from 1941 to 47. Throughout that period, I note, he was the chairman of the Sydney Cricket Ground, which is interesting how you can do both. And he did both, and he did them both well, and only the appointment to the vice-regal office of Governor-General caused him to end his association with the SCG. Now, after that aside, the McKill model is designed expressly to resolve the tensions between Labor in government and the ranks of party members and union officials who make that government possible. The core principle of the McKill model is that Labor governments must be able to govern without interference from the party. That's critical. But there's a corresponding obligation on the parliamentary leader to manage the state and the party, not as separate, but as indistinguishable responsibilities of equal importance. The model served New South Wales Labor for 24 years, continuously from 1941 to 65, under five premiers. Served Rann and Unsworth for another 12, and then all of the 10 years of Bob Carr. By next year, the McKill model will be 70 years old. New South Wales Labor will have been in power for 52 of those 70 years. The events of 2008 broke the model. It is smashed to pieces. I was arguing that the end of the model would end a lot more than a Premier or a Labor government. The known political universe would not be the same for New South Wales Labor without the model. So it is proven. And so next March it will come to pass. The annual conference of May 2008 was one of the more explosive of modern times. Factional divisions meant nothing. The party machine, affiliated unions, and fairly well all of the delegates from electorate councils voted against the proposals of the Yemma government on electricity by a margin of 702 to 107. A narrative of that event, laced with historical background, constituted the third essay, which your Stephen Matchett, I'm not sure of Stephen's status, but he regularly writes for the Sydney Institute, was kind enough to compare this part of my book to Robert Caro's History of the Filibuster in the US Senate, which is high praise indeed. If you can be fascinated by the history of the filibuster, you can enjoy the sort of writing that I've attempted here. I had attempted to describe politics as theatre by reporting character and movement as it was happening or soon after. I hope that I captured an immediacy that provides a counterpoint to the pace of the rest of the book. Of the newsletter essays, this was the least change for the book. When the government defied this express direction of conference, a fourth essay explored the consequences of defiance. Both sides of Labor's war now depended on the attitude of Barry O'Farrell and the coalition parties. We were in looking glass land. The Labor movement was lobbying the Conservative opposition to protect it from the legislative designs of a Labor government. Expecting that the leadership of Maurice Yemma was coming to an end, I explored in the fifth essay the mechanisms by which New South Wales Labor had changed leaders since 1939, with particular attention to the intricacies of 1973, when Neville Rann stood for the leadership at one of his first meeting of caucus, in contrast to the knuckleheaded handling of the succession to Neville under the stage of the Sydney Town Hall 13 years later. I was suspecting by then another change was imminent. The fall of Maurice Yemma in September required an examination of the detailed planning involved in the plot. I wanted to ascribe authorship and determined motivation. People were completely frank after the fall about what they'd done. Though curiously, players prefer not to be named as a source when the context reveals that the only possible source for the actions and motivation of the person named is the person named. Then and only then, with the fall of Maurice, did I think there might be a book in all of these words. It's rare in politics to have an issue resolved so neatly. With so much at stake, Maurice had dared mightily, Maurice had placed everything on the line, Maurice had lost everything. I discussed the prospect of a book with Tony Moore of Cambridge University Press. He agreed there was a book in it, he was a newsletter subscriber. That was October 2008. We thought fondly at the beginning that a book would be little more than stapling the essays together with a few connecting threads. It proved not to be so. For a work that I intended to be a serious academic study, as well as a rattling good yarn, I realised that the history of the founding of the party in New South Wales needed telling inside the prism of the tragedy of 2008. As it turned out, a third as much writing again was required to bring the story unto 1939, the year of that McKell became leader. A great deal of context was needed to explain the rise of Maurice Yemmer, conventional biography. Then the trouble he entered as soon as he pulled off that remarkable victory in the state election of 2007. For a writer who loves the words he has created, I hate to face up to the creative destruction of so much that I have written, because the repetition essential to a serial is not necessary in a book, nor was the style and the tone of insiderness at all appropriate. And politics did not keep still. A few lines on how Nathan Rees was coping by way of an epilogue was becoming a whole new, vital story. The undermining of Nathan revealed what New South Wales Labor had become in graphic etchings. Nathan's leadership was in trouble from his first week. He was confronting a cavern of black treachery. A book published in the beginning of 2009 was a story half untold. The book could not start until the leadership of Nathan was determined, which was likely to be before Christmas 2009, but there was no certainty about that or any other date, except it was likely to end. Yet if Nathan survived calendar year 2009, he was likely to survive until the state election of 2010. There would just probably not be enough space. But the staging of annual conference in November, it brought on the end game. The authority that Nathan sought at that conference and gained, and how he exercised that authority ensured that the end was swift. The fall of Nathan brought the book to a definitive end. That's December 2009. Finishing the book, unlike the subject matter, was neither swift nor surgical. I certainly possessed a vast body of writing. I had an ending. I had interviews with the plotters. I had interviews with Nathan in his circle. The reports in the newspapers were of value only in explaining the case of the government, which newspapers did explain most faithfully, but it was a caricature that assumed all virtue was with those who would privatise. In the Parliamentary Library, I read every cutting. Well organised, beautifully done, the system, the organisation of those cuttings. My purpose was not information. My purpose was to assemble a catalogue of reported certainty that Maurice was safe as houses, a position unchanged and unchanging up to the eve of his fall. And if you read the book, you'll see that I have had some fun in breakouts highlighting the many quotes of the reporters of the time predicting that Maurice was absolutely beyond challenge. And I have there's a sub-theme in the book about the failure of the media to grasp the story. They had not a clue about the significance of the pledge to the Labor stalwart, and no interest. They had no interest in how Labor governs. The obligations of Labor members of Parliament contained in the express wording of the pledge did not get a Guernsey in this reportage. Not when the central line of the reportage across all the media was a heroic story of elected government takes on self-interested union leadership. That was a template for everything they said and wrote. I tremble about historians relying on daily newspapers for any understanding of the workings of our major parties. But my account had its own gap, and it was a huge gap. I'd not spoken to Maurice Yemmer. Certainly I'd listened to Maurice at the conference. I'd conversed with him at the Sydney Cricket Ground in his time as Premier. I'd read every word reported and the official reports. I had no doubt about his thinking, but was that enough? I thought not. Approaching a bloke whose career was in ruins was not a likely prospect. But likely or not, I had to make that approach and deal with the response. There were serious delicacies here, a likelihood of rebuff, but these things have to be done. But they could also take their time. So I reconstructed the fall of Nathan. That was project enough for Christmas 2009. And then at the Pakistan test at the Sydney Cricket Ground, which of course has since become famous, Kevin Green, the Minister for Sport, sought my opinion about appointing Maurice Yemmer to the high ecclesiastical duties involved in being a trustee of the Sydney Cricket Ground. I had but one question, the question I always ask. Does Maurice want this appointment more than anything else he's ever done? Said Kevin, I expect no less. And with that, the decision of Kevin, which enjoyed the blessings he received.
nearly came to pass. Now, having a trustee who was the main character in a book written by his chairman certainly was going to make for an interesting chemistry. So we had a discussion. The matter of the book I explained. A few of us had a private welcome lunch for Morris. I broached what I had written, and he had a pretty good idea of where my thoughts were, where virtue would fall, and what I hoped yet to do. Morris there and then rattled off explanations on what had occurred through 2007-08. With not a notebook I listened, with not a note taken, I was enthralled. Could he repeat this feat of memory in front of someone who was scribbling away? Would he? He would. In the cafe by the pool at the City Cricket Ground, Morris and I sat down. I threw him the same questions as at the restaurant lunch, and he recounted every nuance of what he had said previously. It was awesome. Very few people have such a well-ordered memory as Morris Yemmer, and his ability to explain what was said, attempt to understand the motives of those who were opposed to him, to give a background context, to move it forward, and to hold your attention the whole while. He's a very impressive teller of stories and an analyst of a scenario. One interview, which I thought might serve to round out sentences already on the page, an hour or so maybe, that first interview went for several hours. Morris advised a mutual friend he thought I might have more questions and I should not hesitate to contact him. You might note that we were still at a stage of wariness. He knew well I'd taken a different view on electricity, and the arc of my narrative was not likely to be sympathetic to his government. We met again. We met again and we met again. And in between, I checked details in phone calls, and the phone calls went on and on. Face to face, we explored what happened. The interviews passed 11 hours, not including telephone calls, and asked, for example, about the General Secretary the day that he put to Morris, "It's time for you to stand down. We want to replace you as Premier." Morris, with no apparent emotion, affirmed almost every detail what the General Secretary and the General Secretary's friends had told me about what the General Secretary had said to Morris. This was, of course, simply marvellous. People had not been spinning me a yarn and not been telling things with an angle. Almost always, Morris, in confirming what had happened, denied the central interpretation of his enemies, and those denials by him and by his opponents are through the book. But the key events in the narrative, and who was there and who said what, are essentially affirmed by both sides. He confirmed, when tested, that an exchange had taken place at and where I'd been told. So I note in my notes on sources, other conversations will confirm, enhance, or undermine an earlier conversation. Honest witnesses to the same event will have a different recall. What was central to one was peripheral to others. To ask Morris about his pledge and his intentions following the conference direction was a question about as difficult as ever I put to anyone. The question hung heavily in the air. And you can read in these pages about how Morris answered it. The book finished differently to how it started. Not so differently that I changed my view that the conference has a right to overrule Labor governments. Not so differently that I changed my view that the decision of conference in May 2008 was correct. Amid the reviews and the coverage of the book, others will make of this text what they will. I hope that, for the sake of Australian Labor in an adversary democracy, the book has explained that the ALP is a party of rules, a party of constituted authority and powerful traditions. Solidarity is not an expression, but the central ethos of the party in action. The crisis I recount is about a crisis in Australian Labor in New South Wales, 2007 to 2009. But it's a crisis just as much of Western democracy, a crisis of participation, a crisis of belief, a crisis in getting the electorate to care about who governs them. The book is a dark and ugly tale. The possibilities for parties led by women, by men and women of belief, led by men and women of belief and values, nonetheless remain sublime. Happy to answer questions.
Many thanks to Roger Cavalier. Power crisis, the self-destruction of a state Labor Party is here, and Robert Grundy's got some copies up there, and I'm sure Rodney Cavalier would be happy to sign a copy. Before we come to questions and discussion, I probably should have said that in introducing you that you're chairman of the Sydney Cricket Ground Trust. That's the proper term. Many people know that, but since it was mentioned in the speech, I probably should make that clear for those listening on our iPod or on Channel 648 on Foxtel and Austar. And I should also thank Gilbert and Tobin for the use of this facility this evening. So we come to questions and discussion. As you make clear in your talk, in a sense, the outcome for the Labor Party of this crisis was made possible by the decision of Barry O'Farrell and the Liberal and National parties in the New South Wales Parliament. Now, if Barry O'Farrell had asked me what he should do politically, apart from the issue of privatisation, how he should have handled this politically, I would have said, put it through, because this will cause an enormous division in the Labor Party of New South Wales, as deep as that of the Lang split. What's your assessment of that? What's your assessment of Barry O'Farrell's tactics insofar as they impacted on the Labor Party?
Yep.
Let's come back here. And,
Well, I deal with this in the book, and I could probably find it quickly, but in essence, I endorse what Barry did. I think it's the job of an opposition to oppose. I think that if the opposition had done what you recommended, the Liberal Party would have been seriously divided. The Country Party or the National Party would have split from the Liberal Party. The Labor Party would have been rescued, or the Labor government would have been rescued from a collapse that duly occurred. And I think that the balance of virtue would have switched, that whereas Maurice Yemma would have got all the brownie points for standing up to the powers that be that constitute the Labor Party, Barry would have been seen as being a patsy for the big end of town, the Murdoch press, the Fairfax press, and dare I say it, Jared.
Rodney, when you make those telling points, don't walk away.
Okay.
Just stay here because they want your vision. Lindsay.
When you were a minister, you were described from time to time as a left winger. Without going into what that meant, either state or federal, as a general proposition, the concept meant perhaps more union indulgence, more government, less pro-American, more protection, what have you. I know from time to time you put on the Federation. But at the same time as the Labor Party, you say, is suffering the malaise through the lack of ideology, that left-wing component has drifted and the Labor Party is becoming much more successful as in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s in the States and in the Commonwealth. Is there a paradox there? The Federal Conference has become a rubber stamp for changing the policy at the behest of the government with uranium and what have you. You see there's a paradox that as the ideology has disappeared, as there are less people running the party, as we have these identical candidates, nevertheless, the party at both levels is much more successful than it used to be.
Okay. The period of where that success begins, which is the election of the Rand government and then subsequent landslide, there was certainly a viable, coherent, ideologically based left. When Hawke came to power in 83, there was a left, and the left fought the battle of ideas for at least the next 6 years. I deal in the book with this, a long passage on the death of an ALP left. The steering committee in New South Wales, which was the organisation of the non-parliamentary left, and it's one of those delicious things about politics. When there was a left in New South Wales that believed in socialism and opposing the right, it called itself the steering committee. On the night that it changed its name, on the very night that the wall in Berlin fell, which was a signal to the world, the Cold War is coming to an end, and these terms of left and right are just about dead ducks. On that very night, it changed its name to Socialist Left. When people stop believing in socialism and stop believing in opposing the right. There's a lovely and delicious joke, which is not a joke at all. How can you tell what faction of the left X belongs to? You can tell that by what faction of the right they're dealing with. The left is involved in a deadly competition to who can be best incorporated by the right. There is no battle of ideas. And I would suggest to you that 21 August and the campaign that preceded it was a most chilling statement to the nation. The Labor Party has a crisis of belief. We had witnessed over the previous 3 years an inability to persuade. How can you persuade if you can't advocate? And how can you advocate if you don't have a core of ideas in which you believe? So the left was integral to the Rand government. The Deputy Premier to Neville Rand was one of the great men of our time in Jack Ferguson, and he believed in all this stuff. Believed in it as just part of the marrow and the oxygen of the world. And there was a significant... I mean, I would argue that Australian politics was in a prism that was basically left from 1941 to 83. And I make the outrageous statement that R.G. Menzies was well to the left of any minister in the Hawke government or anyone since. R.G. Menzies believed in full employment, high levels of taxation, pump priming of the economy, the redistribution of opportunity. He believed in funding universities, a fundamental obligation of the Commonwealth. No one believes in that stuff anymore.
Yes.
Thank you on that question. One of the problems with the Victorian living in New South Wales for 25 years, it seems to be that one of the problems for Labor in the state has been power too often, too long. And so power has become the real thing, running the state, making sure that all the little cliques and power centres were in control, certainly hardly in control. To what extent is that the problem? It's really had it too easy for too long. Maybe that's the opposition.
It's a good problem to have, and I would note that for much of my life the Victorians were out of power, and hence Melbourne and Melbourne Labor, Victorian Labor, was a great believer in Commonwealth power, because that would be the nearest they get to the levers of power, whereas we were great state riders because we thought we might have a say in these things. It's tended to be very different since federal intervention in 70 in Victoria. Labor still took another 12 years for Labor to come to power under... John Cain Jr., but we've been in power in Victoria most of the time since, and they've been pretty good governments. So, I mean, Ian, there is some merit in what you say, but remember that the McKell model was very much about managing well. We didn't use words like managing. It was, you've got to look after Joe Blow and his missus. So you made the trains run on time, and you made sure the train service went to Cootamundra and Young. It was just what you did, because it was visceral to what Labor was about. You weren't dictated to by Treasury. Treasury was there to tell you how you put together the resources, not to come into the cabinet room and tell you how you couldn't do it. The Rand government was a Labor government that very much believed the cabinet ran the state and wasn't dictated to by Treasury. The Treasury's become high and mighty in all polities around Australia, and I was pleased to see a couple of weeks ago Gerry Gleeson made the same point.
There's a question over there. Yeah.
Mr. Cavalier, I belong to the other team. but I'm very interested in the reports in the newspaper, and I will buy your book and read it, about your comments about the death of the branches. And in the newspaper reports, you imply that somehow the Liberal branches are doing better. My feelings are that they're all dying. Is it due to the fact that we're getting to a post-era of ideology, that we can't get people involved locally?
We are. I'm sorry if I gave any impression the Liberals are doing better, because plenty of Libs at the most senior level have told me that what we need is a book like this about the Liberal Party. And I've been given data about the collapse of their branches. And a fellow called John Hyde Page wrote a very good book, which didn't get the critical acclaim it warranted, pointing out the crisis of the Liberal Party below. I do think we have a crisis. I said we're a crisis of Western democracy, a crisis of participation. If we were the Girl Guides, Rotary, the Boy Scouts, the PNCs, we would be talking about the same problem. How do you get people out? My son's involved in a viable, very good soccer competition in the Southern Islands, but the number of parents who go to the meetings, as distinct from involving coaching, an umpire, a refereeing, and being on the sidelines and marking the lines, it's tiny. To actually get people involved in going to a meeting is a different thing to get people to work. And people don't want to go out at night. And there is this, what I regard as dangerous and preposterous notion, if we get at the end of a computer and go tap, 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 and someone reads at the other end on a screen, that hour somehow or other is going to enhance democracy. I don't know how you could understand anyone's ultimate value of going into Parliament unless you determine the cut of his or her jib.
Thank you.
question here?
Yes. A question that may be unrelated to your topic. My question is, was Kevin Rudd really that bad of a leader? His personality was that dislikable to have to be disposed the way he was disposed.
Well, Jared tells me everything that I say tonight will go to air on television. I recommend you read a new book by Barry Cassidy. You're obviously not a reader of the newsletter. I had been writing about this all of 2010, and about 8 days before he fell, I predicted that, quote, either the Caucus acts or the nation will. So that may well be a clue to my thinking on the matter. And maybe in the fullness of time, people will give whatever else they do, Bill Shorten and Mark Abib deserve an acknowledgement for what they did that day and night.
I agree with that. There's a question there. Yeah, there we go. Okay, here.
Did you seek out to interview Michael Costa, who has been seen by the newspapers or by the public, rightly or wrongly, as a ideologue or a greater motivator of this electricity privatization than Yema himself? And Yema might merely have been the fall guy for Costa, and if so, what was his response, or what would you have expected his response to be?
Morris was no fall guy for anyone. Morris was certainly persuaded by Michael and Treasury this was the way to go. I didn't have to interview Michael. I've heard him talk many times over the years on this. Michael is a true disciple, true believer in von Hayek. He's a believer in market forces in a way that's really quite remarkable for a member of the Labor Party. He's sincere. He doesn't think it provides any conflict with his Labor Party membership. And I knew I didn't have to talk to him. A book expressing his views would be penned, was being penned by Simon Benson. If you want to know Morris's views, read Simon Benson's book. Michael's views, sorry.
Yes.
Do you anticipate that the result of the March 2011 election is going to be worse for Labor than it was in March 1988?
My answer to this, when I've been asked the question by Deborah Cameron and co, is that writing the book didn't make me a forecaster. So let me answer it this way, to say that the destruction of the McKell model, which led to 70 years of Labor hegemony, will have consequences. And I think there are other elections pre-1988 that you might look to as an example of the sort of outcome that might come to pass.
Are you able to say what those are?
No. I'll tell you privately.
Yes.
Yes. Seeing how electricity bills have been going up very severely since in the last 2 years, do you think privatisation of electricity would have prevented that?
No, I don't. I think that what we're involved in now and will be over the next 10 years is 65 years of catch-up. The governments of Australia, for good and sufficient reasons after the war, needed to rebuild the country, rebuild the economy, make electricity cheap to foreigners and for our own domestic manufacturers. So prices were artificially low. I was the Minister for Energy for all of 10 weeks. But even in that time, I could see that we were charging ridiculous prices. Government depressed them. There was a great institution called the Electricity Commission. There were the county councils. There's another former Minister for Energy in the room. There was always going to be a day of reckoning. I'm amazed that it was more than 26 years after I held the portfolio. And regardless of climate change, regardless of privatisation, Australia's going to have to pay a lot more for electricity bills. The price of coal, much of which is exported, is soared because of world demand for it. There's no longer cheap coal to be sold to Australians' generators to burn. The beauty of privatisation, of course, is that the government doesn't get it in the eye when prices go up. Governments are responsible for rail fares, they're not responsible for airfares. The fact that airfares are where they are is just part of the fabric of market forces.
But airfares have been going down.
They have been in recent time. They also went up for a very long time.
Down the back? Yeah, and over here, yes.
I went to an AGM today, a coffee, borrowing beer people, and it's just staggering that there's an organisation of a group of people who can do wonderful things around the world in 50 countries, and they're basically sitting based. And yet, you know, so we've got so many millions of people in New South Wales, and yet the standard of politicians that with a notable difference, are pretty mundane in terms of world leaders. How come we can't, why don't we have something like a primary system to not to attract people who are too busy, you know, running families and businesses or communities, to actually get them involved in
To have a primary system like the United States means major legislative change. If you've been in the United States, you go to any of their post offices or equivalent institutions, you take a form, as I did in California, you fill out your name and address and everything else, and you declare whether you're a Democrat, a Republican or something else. And that is all that's involved in getting registered to vote in the respective primary. The taxpayers pay for everything else. It's a very significant cost for the taxpayer to have a fully-fledged primary election in a place like California running into the millions. You can imagine in some of the safe Labor or Liberal seats it would run into the tens of thousands. Either it gets charged back to the parties, which is an interesting thought. Since they get public funding, they could undoubtedly now afford it. But it means a reconstruction of our constitutional assumptions and a large measure of state intrusion in the affairs of political parties, none of which I have a problem with. Then you have to think about the costs involved. It's no longer going to be a matter of knocking on the doors of 28 or 280 branch members. You're almost certainly going to need a profile of the kind you're talking about, which you regard as a virtue. The old-fashioned way of being a stalwart, working your way through the branches and impressing other stalwarts, I suspect would be replaced by people of some public identity, if not notoriety. Again, there may not be a problem in that. But it will be a completely different type of MP who emerges. And I'm not sure that the person who is concerned about the intrusion in their time and their private life, not to mention the massive drop in income possibilities, will be any more attracted by a primary system.
Just down the back and over here.
Having just been in the States, please don't bring American democracy to Australia. Particularly with the amount of the gutter comments that are made about opposing politicians and even people being elected to judge. That's not my question. You mentioned the crisis of democracy. To what extent in all the major parties, but particularly the Liberals and the Labor, can you attribute that crisis and the lack of participation to the growth of apparatchiks and the several generations of politicians within a family, rather than trying to bring into the fold people who've had real life experience rather than working as advisors to ministers and then getting promoted?
You're going to love the book. I regard that as the central great problem of Labor, and it's becoming the problem of the Liberal Party. I mentioned to a former Liberal Prime Minister about 10 years ago this was a major problem for Labor. We're talking at the Cricket Ground, he said, yes, and it's becoming one for us, but we're behind you. I would suggest to you, when you look at the most recent round of pre-selections, the Liberals have caught up. And so we have what some people call the nomenclatura, the apparatchiks, what I call the political class, and I lay claim to authorship of that phrase. People employed in the Labor Party context by a trade union, a minister, or the ALP office have a colossal advantage over everyone else, moving to a near monopoly advantage. Unless you're inside that neck of the bottle, and you just almost got no chance. You contrast that with, say, a Jack Ferguson, who was a bricklayer, living at Guildford, doing jobs at George's Heights and Mossman, travelling in dark by train and by other means to get to Mossman to do the bricklaying, to get home, to go to Parramatta City Council at night to a Labor Party meeting and having the kids. Imagine if he was up against someone who was in a white-collar job in the city working for Joe Carl, who could cut his throat for 8 hours uninterrupted. It's just not a fair field. And so my solution in the package of reforms I'll be putting to the committee on which John Faulkner's on is two critical changes. Break the power of the unions by reducing their say at annual conference from the present 50 to somewhere between 0 and about 8%, and put an absolute ban on ministerial staffers and the political class from standing for pre-selection until at least 5 years after they've left that employment. That will create a blast of oxygen which will be fabulous for the parties.
But how many Fergusons are there in Parliament?
Yeah. I do note Martin is a member in a seat in Melbourne. He won on his own merit from the position of president of the ACTU. Laurie won a seat which was not his father's seat in a rank and file ballot. I'll stop at that. And incidentally was used during the campaign because he knew what he was talking about. That was pretty remarkable to have a candidate speaking with authority on major public issues because he knew something.
No, it's a question over here. Yeah.
Would you comment on the proposal of Jerry Gleeson that the public, the absence of an effective public service board has been to the detriment of New South Wales politics, and also that the taxpayers should fund party political campaigns and donations be abolished? And finally, the comment of the Sydney Morning Herald that promotion within the state, New South, within the past 10 years in the state bureaucracy has been on the basis of party loyalty rather than professional competence.
Right.
Do you think these three factors damage the Labor Party?
If one and two are true, that's undoubtedly the case. But going back to one, I strongly believe in the reintroduction of a public service board. John Faulkner was moving in that direction as the federal minister, special minister of state. Let us pause and remember in terms of virtue and vice, it was Nick Greiner who abolished the public service board. It's Nick who creates the large private army that serves the Premier of the day and creates a cabinet office. Jerry Gleeson, inside, underneath his hat, as Secretary of Premiers, did all of the work of the Cabinet Office, and the former Minister Secretary of one of the RAND cabinets here, who will tell you about how closely he followed affairs and was responsible with great integrity for putting the decisions of Cabinet into writing and the basis of instructions to the Parliamentary Council. I am a strong supporter of a public service board, the ending of contracts, and the reintroduction of permanency. I think that the disappearance of permanency has meant the end of frank and fearless advice. In our time, to talk personally, the Directors Generals of TAFE and Education stood up to me on a regular basis. Today, I fear, all too much of it is trying to find out what the Minister wants and then telling him what he wants to hear. I noticed that Barry O'Farrell has talked about bringing back a public service commission. What was question part two?
Political donations began to the taxpayer fund.
I was the one who wrote back in 1980, going into 81, the first public funding reforms for New South Wales. A committee chaired by Ernie Quinn, from which the coalition withdrew, so we had a carte blanche and it became the law of the land. Much debauched and weakened since. My only concern about the state taking over all donations, it not only means that developers can't donate or hotel interests or allegedly unsavoury elements of society, it also means parties can't donate to themselves. Suddenly, the humble barbecue of the Southern Highlands branch and the grand ball of the Linfield branch of the Liberal Party, you raise the money, that's fine, but you can't give the money to the party. I'm also worried about how a new party emerges. There's nothing in the scriptures that says that Labor, Liberal and Country Party are the only parties that are there. They will have a colossal advantage going into the next election, getting funding from the previous. It would be so much harder for a new political force to emerge. So no, I'm not a supporter, I've written about this, and I reckon that is a very dangerous step. And one of the scenarios I talk about in the book, imagine if the split had occurred within the ranks of Labor. Who was the Australian Labor Party? The office that was registered at Sussex Street or the parliamentary leadership? And these become million-dollar questions.
Do you have any comment on the current differences between Julia and Christina regarding health and safety?
No, except that they both seem to be quite heartfelt in their attitude towards each other.
Tell us a bit about your role as a minister. One of the questioners said earlier on that you you had some altercations with the Teachers Federation. I think it's also true that in terms of the first 3 years of the current Labor government, that Julia Gillard was quite successful in confronting and prevailing over the what was essentially the left-wing Teachers Federation. Well, what was your thought process behind that when you were minister?
Well, in a sentence, Gerard, I believe that it was no role of the Teachers Federation to be involved in the prerogatives of management. For example, intensive language units at Cleveland Street, it wasn't up to them to unilaterally reduce class sizes. That sort of stunt, which they seemed to think was great fun, with considerable resource implications, came to an end. And having been a poacher, having worked in the unions, I knew their mentality absolutely inside out. I'd read books like Rules for Radicals about how to muck up bureaucracies, and I had a series of counter-strategies. And I took the view of Stan McCabe, if the ball comes at my head, I'll step inside the line and hit it over the fence. So each time I responded to a grossly offensive comment, in essentially the same grossly offensive terms, I'd been provocative. I unleashed the district inspectors and the people on the ground in the department. I said, when they tell lies, nail them as lies. When they abuse you, abuse them back. Got complaints, the inspectors aren't treating us the way they used to. Well, they're not going to be Aunt Sally's for you to build around. And of course, the one that most people remember is the beginning of the school year in 1985, a teacher at Bega High decided he didn't want to move to where he was being sent at Bombala because he thought he was needed at Bega, which is a legitimate point of view. And he used up the processes to put that point of view, and he didn't persuade the Director General. Now remember, between the end of one school year and the next, there is a military the scale of transfers and of course leaving people in place and promotions is of a military kind, and 6 weeks is not a lot of time to do it. And we dealt with some, I can't remember the numbers now exactly, Jerry, but many thousands, if not 12,000, out of which three people were ultimately unhappy, three people were faced with dismissal, two folded and one was left, and was properly dismissed by the Director General, upheld by the Industrial Commission. And after a series of rolling strikes, which had no impact, the Teachers Federation had to go back to work, having lost the issue hook, line and sinker. And I think that part of future success of ministers is we settle for all time that the Teachers Federation would not be involved in the management of the education portfolio, for which I make no apology. And John Faulkner, at the launch of the cricket ground last week, remembered that the Teachers Federation lodged an official complaint with the steering committee about my provocative anti-union behaviour. And the steering committee, instead of laughing, set up a trial. And the trial took place without my participation. And at the end of which, there was a form of words, but I didn't have to go to Devil's Island or even Port Arthur. And the Herald, I believe it was Moy, did a wonderful cartoon of me being whipped with a feather with a jury of kangaroos looking on.
I think that's a nice place to leave it.
Okay.
Just stand aside for a second. But it's right on, or very close to 7 o'clock, so I'll just very briefly thank our speaker. It's great to have Rodney Cavalier at the Sydney Institute. I've always admired his writings. I also admired his role as a minister in the Labor government in New South Wales, and now he's become an author of what is quite a remarkable book, partly because of the sources and partly because of the arguments contained within it. So it's great you've come here today and spoken about how and why you wrote the book. The copies of the book over there, but I'm sure I think this is your first book.
It is.
I doubt that it's going to be your last book, since you write so much. Some of it's going to end up elsewhere in books. But until then, no doubt we'll have you back, and perhaps before. But for tonight, well done, and good luck with the book.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.